Hello, this is Earl Fontenelle. You're listening to The Schwepp, the Secret History of Western Esotericism podcast. Today, we are absolutely delighted to be speaking with Maria Papathanasiou, Emerita Professor in the Department of Mathematics at Kapodistrian and National University at Athens, a woman who literally wrote the book on the great Stephanos of Alexandria. Before we get started, well, two things. First of all, Maria, thank you so much for taking the time to come and speak with us. Much appreciated. And secondly, this is a special episode because Maria has gone well above and beyond the call of duty and prepared a PowerPoint presentation, which you can go to www.schwepp.net, download, and follow along as we go through the life and works of the great Stephanos. And you, I mean, the amount of knowledge that's in there is pretty comprehensive. You'll be able to get an amazingly detailed picture of this gentleman, his works. But let's get started. So, Maria, Stephanos of Alexandria, I guess the first thing to do is give a picture of the basic biography of this gentleman, as far as we know. And maybe talk about the questions about his biography as well, because there's a Stephanos of Athens. Some people have tried to say he's a different person. There's a lot of questions about, did he actually write all the things that are attributed to him? So what do we know about his life in a basic way?
Well, generally, we know that Stephanos of Alexandria was a prominent Byzantine scholar at the turn of the 6th to the 7th centuries, and very well known as a commentator on Plato and Aristotle. But tradition attributed him also with astronomical, astrological, alchemical, and medical works under the names Stephanos the philosopher, Stephanos the Athenian philosopher, and is designated also especially as ecumenical teacher and practical philosopher. Well, there is a debate if Stephanos of Alexandria is the same person as Stephanos of Athens. I think that it is the same person, because the designation Alexandrian does not indicate his native city, but that when he settled in Constantinople, he came from Alexandria. So he was most likely born at Athens, but his time in Alexandria with his studies and his career make him to be renowned as Alexandrian, because he was a very renowned scholar there, interested in philosophy, medicine, science, before moving circa 617 to Constantinople, where the Emperor Heraclius invited him to teach the quadrivium. And the quadrivium were science, actually, not exactly philosophy.
The mathematical arts, basically.
Yes, the mathematical sciences. And to be invited by the emperor, it means that he was really a very exceptional personality at his time.
Yeah. So this is, you know, if we're thinking about the history of teaching at Alexandria, we kind of have a final detailed knowledge of the era of Olympiodorus. Damascius wrote his commentary that we have in fragments. So we get a picture of the sort of 6th century and things. Then we get these vague writers called Elias and David who wrote Aristotelian commentaries, but we don't really know much about their identity. But then in the 7th century, we have this Stephanos, and he sort of emerges into the light of history with some commentaries on Aristotle, but also as a person. You know, a lot of people talk about him and his activity. So we can at least say that traditional philosophic stroke scientific teaching in Alexandria is still going on in some form into the era of Heraclius. Now, Egypt remains Roman for not very long after that, unfortunately. The Romans they're going to lose Egypt.
Yes.
So this is maybe the final generation of Alexandrian scholars of that sort of old tradition.
Yes, exactly. Stephanos of Alexandria is the last Byzantine scholar before the fall of Alexandria, before the Arab occupation of Alexandria.
Mm.
And he's the last also commentator. Yes, it's sure that the school of Olympiodorus in Alexandria was still active when Stephanos left his native city and visited Alexandria. It was possible to him to study there and work there and make his career as commentator and also as a scientist on Quadrivium. We don't know his commentary on Plato. There is nothing left. But we know his commentaries on Aristotle, naturally under the name of Stephanos, especially of Athens. It's on interpretations, the third book on the anima, and we have indirectly mentioned on analytics, on sophistic Hellenic, and on heaven.
So he's reading Aristotle, he's reading in a long tradition established at Alexandria of reading Aristotle, an Aristotle harmonized with many ideas from Platonism. But he doesn't seem overtly interested in harmonizing all that material with Christian revelation. He just says, there is a Christian revelation, but anyway, let's talk about the eternity of the cosmos.
Yes, I think that these commentators were very clever because they didn't deny Christian faith. They tried to reconcile Aristotelian ideas with Christian faith on the basis of that possibly Aristotle was misunderstood.
Right. Okay. Yeah. He's easy to misunderstand, right? So you have a lot of room to run around there. So Stephanos comes, we don't know how long he was studying in Alexandria, but seemingly he gained a great eminence, right? To the point where he's invited to Constantinople by Heraclius. Heraclius is for those not following the history side of the history very much, he's probably the next truly important emperor after Justinian, in the sense that he reigns for a long time. He's the one who has to try to defend the empire when the Arabs come through, which he succeeds in doing to a better degree than the Sasanians did, but he still loses a lot of territory. But despite all the setbacks he faced, he's a very powerful emperor, and presumably being invited to his court was a great honor, and it was probably a really important kind of intellectual place. So we have Stephanos there, and he's teaching. Do we know how long he lives in Constantinople before he finally dies, or is that just lost information?
My opinion is that, okay, he was invited about 616 because Heraclius was emperor from 5 October 610, and we have the astronomical work of Stephanos, we have, and we know that the examples given in this commentary on the handy tables of Ptolemy according to Theo is during the period 617 to 619. So it's sure that Stephanos was already there.
Right.
And I would like to say that the date of the astrological work is September 621. My date for the astronomical work is June 617. So it's about 4 years where all dates coincide. I think that Stephanos was old when he settled in Constantinople. And possibly the horoscope of Islam, or his Aποτελεσματική Πραγματεία, as he said, is his last work. And possibly after that time, he was either dead or all silent. There are also some questions about the conflicts about these officials, ecclesiastic officials, with orthodoxy, with monophysites, and so on. And all this could also play some role in the recognition of Stephanos.
Mm. So you just casually mentioned some astronomical observations, but I just want to make this explicit. This is a piece of very beautiful forensic astronomy that you've done, where you've gone back and discussed a observation that Stephanos makes in his work to the stars and planets over Constantinople at a given time, figured out the date he must have made that observation, and said, okay, he must have been in Constantinople at that time. It's very rare that we can use hard science to date something like that, but it's wonderful when it happens, and you've been able to do it for Stephanos. One of the things that this shows us is that it's much more likely, the case that you make, that the author of both the Aristotelian commentaries and the astronomy and astrology and alchemical works are all one person, because this is clearly Stephanos being at Constantinople at a given time, observing this very significant stellar event. So let's talk a little bit more about his astronomical work. He's commenting on the handy tables of Ptolemy. Ptolemy, we've talked about in the podcast. He's like a second century philosophically inclined, not so much a practical astrologer, but someone who wants to theorize astrology and also, you know, also useful practically. He's going to go on to be the most important astrologer into the Arab tradition until Abu Mashar sort of updates him.
It's sure that Stephanos studied astronomy and astrology in Alexandria.
Yeah.
And the astronomical, his astronomical work, which is the commentary of Ptolemy's handy tables edited by Theon. What is this? The tables, these tables were used for the determination of the places of the planets and the phases of the moon. And they were necessary, these tables, for the astronomical calculation, astronomical calculations. But the same astronomical calculations could be used by the astrologers to cast a horoscope. But these tables were written, actually calculated, for the geographical coordinates of Alexandria. Stephanos tried to adapt these tables for the geographical coordinates of Constantinople. Changing geographical coordinates, this means that you have to make new calculations and how to find, for example, the dates for the eclipses of the moon and so on. And on this base, we know, actually we can estimate Stephanos' astronomical work. First of all, it's written a little before the Arab occupation of Alexandria. Secondly, it's the last astronomical work which is written only according to the Greek astronomical tradition.
Right.
Because later we have also the influence of the Arabs and Hindus. As I told you, it's written in Constantinople, and it's an adaptation of the tables of Ptolemy's for Alexandria. So we were able, actually, Neugebauer and others, to find out that the place and time of the composition of this table is for the geographical coordinates of Constantinople, and all examples are given for the years 617 to 619, namely during the reign of Emperor Heraclius. And it is exactly in full accordance with the date of the alchemical work.
Mm.
Heraclius liked to have some relation with astrology. He had asked to cast a horoscope for him, and he avoided going to the water because it was a prediction that he would die from being drawn. Yeah.
Now, just as a side note, the Theon you mentioned, who this is the father of Hypatia of Alexandria.
Of Hypatia.
So we talked about Hypatia back in the podcast as well. We don't know much about Theon, but we know he was very important as an influential commentary on Ptolemy. So Stephanos is still working with his commentary on the handy tables of Ptolemy.
Yeah.
That brings us up to date. And a question I have for you is there anything more you can say about the relationship between astronomy and astrology in our period for someone like Stephanos?
Well, astronomy actually studies the ancient astronomy. It was based on geometrical models.
Yeah.
Geometrical models for the motion of the planets, and to be able to predict eclipses, and also to check if their theories were correct, if they would like to observe the planets, because it was only these theories and observations. Astrology is the explanation of the influence of stars, especially planets, on human body, actually in the universe. So the difference is that the one has only its techniques for the places of the heavenly bodies. The other is that he uses the astronomical methods, but in order to have the exact places of the planets and then give their explanation, the astrological explanation.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the horoscope of Islam.
Yeah.
That is a very, very interesting artifact. I wonder if you can tell us about that.
Well, before going to this, let me describe this astronomical phenomenon observed by Stephanos.
Yes, please.
At Constantinople, which is exactly the way I date his work. In one of his lectures, he describes quite poetically a phenomenon, which is clearly an astronomical phenomenon. But as you know, the planets correspond to metals, and so you have very well this idea. It's the same as the planets move in the sky, in the same way the metals, they are mixing with one another in a chemical apparatus. So as he was busy, Stephanos, working on his alchemical lectures, he observed the sky. Why? Because at the same time, as it's evident, he was busy to write also the astronomical work, the handy tables. So he was obliged to observe the sky to check the astronomical examples for his astronomical work. And so he was able, during this time, to observe this phenomenon that he introduced in his alchemical work. It's funny. What is this passage? He says, "Again, the planet of Venus attains the Persian dawn and precedes the rays of the sun. Again, the planet of Mercury, under the rays of the sun, is found in the subsequent zodiacal signs. Again, the planet of Saturn is faintly discernible due to the steepness of the height. again, the planet of Mars is preparing the burning cut. Towards these planets comes the moon, dressed as a bride, and takes up the towered ships of the nine parts. And by means of the moon, the alloy that is in the process of mixing itself does so to perfection. You see already. And then that this whole operation, the three bodies, comprises three bodies, and exhibits the tetrasomia. Tetrasomia, this means four bodies, four metals, as a fourth, proceeding in orderly manner. And they, bodies, planets, run about to serve the most pure one, which is the moon, so that by means of the vigorous conjunctions, they spur themselves on towards the rays of the sun, so that what comes from something perfect and is perfect be combined with other perfect things. Well, all this description gives us an order of the planets. Mercury, which is under the rays of the sun in the subsequent zodiacal signs, and sun are below the horizon. Otherwise, when the sun is above the horizon, you cannot see the planet, the stars. But Venus, Saturn, Mars, and Moon are above the horizon, and ensure that they are described as farther from the ground. So I thought that we have an assembly of these planets in a narrow part of the sky. So I used and I searched by means of a computer program to identify an assembly of the of these planets in a narrow part of the zodiac. As Jupiter is not mentioned, this meant that Jupiter was not visible. Okay, so this search, when you have all these planets to in a narrow part, they can be in any order.
Right.
But here we have also the order. So it should be Mercury and the Sun below the horizon, Venus, Saturn, and Mars all above the horizon, and seen in the eastern sky of Constantinople, because lay Persian Dawn are east. Okay.
Yeah.
From the beginning of the reign of Heraclius, 5 October 610, to the late 10th century, to early 11th century, which is the date of the earliest manuscript, which is Marcianus Graecus 299, that contains the alchemical work. I searched all of these cases, and the only date that satisfies all astronomical conditions is 7 June 617, 4 o'clock, 15 minutes local time, a morning. And this is a date which is in accordance with the examples of the astronomical work between 617 and 619. You see that the date of the one work reinforces actually the date of the other work. If you are not blind to accept that a person can be a good scholar in astronomy and can be also an astrologer.
And an alchemist.
Okay, but Isaac Newton, you know how many alchemical works he had written, and they were actually not permitted to be published. But last year, know, they have been published. Okay, it was not appropriate for the great Isaac Newton to have astrological and alchemical interests.
Yeah. Now, this is a lovely piece of detective work on your part.
Okay. So this is the the phenomenon. Yeah. And I could say also how Stephanos or his disciples could see this phenomenon. This is phenomenon that was evolving during days. It's not a moment. So Stephanos have been observing this phenomenon for many days.
Okay.
But he could have seen near this date Mercury visible as an evening star, low in the west. And the next morning, early at dawn, he could see rising Venus as a morning star, low in the horizon, but visible because of its brightness. Venus is very bright. And a little higher, Venus, Saturn, and then would be in conjunction with the crescent of the waning moon. And Mars would be high in the sky. Okay, we can say also during what period Stephanos was busy writing this lecture, at least this lecture. Well, the position of Mars in the first degree, 39 minutes of Aries, which is the first fiery zodiacal sign, explains why in the text is said that Mars is preparing the burning cat. The first zodiacal sign is a fiery sign, where the zodiac begins. So Mars was moving straight forward through the last degrees of Pisces before entering Aries on 4 June. Meanwhile, the moon, after the full moon of 26 May, would come successively into conjunction with Mars with 3 June, Saturn 7 June, and Venus 8 June, reaching its next conjunction with the Sun, new moon, on 9 June 617. Stephanos does not mention the 3 June conjunction of Moon and Mars in Pisces, and also says that Mars is preparing the burning cat. This means that he was the last degrees of Pisces. This means that Stephanos wrote his lecture, this lecture, sometime after 26 May, but before 3 June 617.
Amazing. Now, this is fascinating for so many reasons, but it allows us to, well, for a few things, it allows us to pinpoint his scholarly activity in Constantinople. Maybe he has some kind of observatory or at least some kind of high window where he can sit in night after night and watch the stars, or like a tower or something. It's cool to imagine him in some kind of a tower.
Well, I don't know. But listen, in the Αποτελεσματική Πραγματεία, in the astrological world, it is said that he was in the garden of his school, of the school.
Okay.
This means that he was somewhere in a building, something like a school. Constantinople had many schools under the states, I could say.
Yeah.
And so it is possible that he was able to observe the stars and make astronomical measurements. At least he had an astrolabe.
Yeah, yeah.
Because as we will see in the astrological work, which is the most important astronomical instrument, immediately after, I could say, Hipparchus.
Yeah.
In all this time from the second century BC and later, because it was Hipparchus, the great Hipparchus, second century BC, who introduced this stereographic projection on which the use of the astrolabe is based. I have worked for 10 years at Eugenides Planetarium, and we have make an astrolabe for the geographical coordinates of Athens under my supervision. Long ago, I mean about 50 years ago, and it was given, actually, we sold it to the visitors of the planetarium.
So you know your astrolabes.
Yeah.
Okay, so Maria, another thing that I find very interesting about this is that this observation appears in an alchemical context. And so Stephanos is doing something which is something that's already been happening, but we see it very clearly in his work, which is creating a synthesis whereby alchemy is fully astrologized. You're doing alchemy in a way that tries to take into account the influences of the stars. And the metals and the stars and the planets are all sort of interlocking in terms of their influence and meaning. So we really see in Stephanos kind of like an esoteric Renaissance man, in the sense that he has a fully integrated occult scientific system where astrology, and alchemy and also medical stuff are all integrated into one system, right?
Well, actually, I don't see so much astrology in his alchemical work. It's rather this general idea that all things are related to one another according to the four primary elements, which is air, fire, water, earth. Mm-hmm. And which was also the base of Greek medicine because of the correspondence with the humors of the human body, black bile, yellow bile, phlegma, and blood, yeah, which are related to one another by the two pairs of opposite qualities, dry and wet, hot and cold. And because this was the basis of all Greek medicine. So you have already these relations. I could say that Stephanos extended in his work some of these relations because he writes that the blood composed of air is warm and humid and resembles quicksilver. Here we have also the metal. Yellow bile, composed of fire, is warm and dry and resembles copper. Mm-hmm. Black bile, composed of earth, is dry and cold and resembles the dross of both quicksilver and copper. And finally, phlegm, composed of water, is well cold and humid and resembles the vapors of a watery solution of gold, which are the souls of copper. You see, Stephanos goes a little farther. It's his opinion,
right?
Actually,
yeah.
Okay, and also we see some other correspondence. For example, he says that the part of the body from the knees to the navel, from the feet to the navel, correspond to white color and to the element earth. Mm. The part from the knees to the navel corresponds to far-shining and translucent, and also to the element water. From navel to the heart, fiery color and the element fire, and finally from heart to the neck, to saffron color and the air, leaving apart the head. Hmm. Why?
Hmm.
Because he said that the head regulates the changes of the humors in the human body exactly as the alternation of the seasons regulates the changes of the juices in nature.
Hmm.
And the changes of the four primary elements into one another and the occurrence of natural phenomena are similar to what takes place in the chemical apparatus. This means that the cover of the earthen pot looks like the sky that covers the Earth, and many changes occur in both the sky and the chemical apparatus, as we see putrefaction and the dross of metals change by exhalation. So what does it mean that what is made in chemical apparatus is an image of what is taking place in the universe?
Mm-hmm.
And for this reason, he talks about the mystery of the philosophers, which, as he says, is carried out by the seven, through the seven planets. The mystery of the philosophers is carried out through the seven planets. And the philosophers call it the egg of the philosophers, which is not laid by a bird. But this refers to the Orphic doctrine in Greek philosophy, which they said that the egg, actually the cosmogonic egg, is older than not only than the bird, but also older than anything in the world. And this egg is a dynamic image of the all of the universe and should be identified with the stone of the philosophers. For this reason, as it is said in the alchemical work, the stone of the philosophers is something which is not precious, but it's very precious, which is known and also unknown. Why? Because for most people, it's nothing. But for the philosopher who sees in all these, I could say, chemical reactions and so on, that he is making the universe. He has the universe in his hand, the alchemist.
Mm. It's all connected.
Yeah, it's all connected.
Microcosm, macrocosm. Amazing stuff.
Yes. And he makes also other correspondences between the signs of the zodiac and also the primary elements. He makes also some very... he says that the 12 signs are 12 powers, towers. And vernal equinox, having the signs, actually the vernal equinox, Aries, Taurus, and Gemini corresponds to air. And then the other one to fire, fall equinox with water, and also winter solstice with the three Capricorn, Aquarius, and Pisces with Earth. So it makes always these correspondences, the universe, the macrocosm, with the microcosm and all other things.
And the human body and the seasons of the Earth, the human body, the alchemical alembic in the laboratory, all, you know, sort of playing out at different scales of the same forces with cycles and epicycles and correspondences.
And, you know, all of this process to make this stone of philosophers and attain the perfection with gold actually is the efforts of the alchemist to attain perfection for themselves. They see in all this process their efforts to assimilate to God, because God is perfect, and as gold is perfect in the material world. So trying to make perfect actually gold is their efforts to attain perfectionism, to be divine.
A form of theosis. Now, what's fascinating here is that Okay, we have earlier alchemical authorities, notably Zosimus of Panopolis. And there are many, many things in Zosimus. And Zosimus, of course, gets read and gets translated into Arabic and has a long life through the Middle Ages. So he's very influential. There are many things in Zosimus that, for example, a student of alchemy in the early modern period in Western Europe will look at Zosimus and say, yes, I recognize that. That's alchemy. But there's lots of other stuff missing from Zosimus. And there's a lot of things in Zosimus that don't really match with that kind of later, early modern Western European alchemy. But if you look at Stephanos's work, everything you've just said basically could applies to Stephanos, but could also apply to Michael Mayer or, you know, any sort of like West European post-Arab transmission Latin language alchemical author. So this guy really is the face of alchemy going forward. He's bringing in all the occult sciences. He's bringing in medicine. He's bringing in, but he's also bringing in the theological notion of perfection, of reversing the process of the fall, bringing matter back to how it's supposed to be in the proper divine way that God wants it to be, but which it isn't. It's up to the philosopher to do that. I'd like to talk to you more about alchemy, about his alchemical work. But before we do that, can we go back and just touch on the horoscope of Islam in the astronomical, astrological section of things? Because that's too interesting to pass up.